this is obviously a huge field, and I'm going to just kind of give a little bit of an overview. I think some of the examples I'm going to show you, you know about, but I want to try to put them in a kind of a broader context and see where it's all, where I think it's kind of coming from, and some of the different ideas that are kind of cutting edge right now, and then it'll be interesting to kind of discuss what are the implications later, right? So, very simplistic. If you go back and look at the last 50, 30 years of kind of technology and education, that's a broad statement, then here's maybe two kind of broad trends, right? Two different ways, very different ways of approaching them. The first is the computer as the teacher. Okay, so it's, you can call it intelligent adaptive tutor systems. There's other words for it. It comes out of behavioralist, I think, pedagogy. Okay, so it's the idea that there is a set body of knowledge, that we understand that body of knowledge, and that we can then program the computer to be the most patient kind of tutor in the world, right? That's kind of a very early idea. And then you have a different approach, which says we don't really want the teacher, the computer to be the teacher, right? We actually, and from constructivist perspective, we don't think there is a set body of knowledge. We think that people need to be involved in the co-construction of knowledge, and typically both individually, but especially collectively as a group, right? However, are there ways in which computers can enhance the individual or collaborative work with ideas? And then I added another there, which is just not really a kind of a theoretical growth, but just in terms of computers and education, obviously, the access to content and the ways of communicating have increased tremendously. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So very, very simplistic model of intelligent tutors. You have a domain model, so you kind of model the knowledge of a field, right? It might be how to do calculations, it might be engineering or economics, typically harder subjects, because that's where you more typically have this bounded knowledge. Languages could also be. Then you have, so the computer interacts with the student, and it uses a pedagogical model, and then it generates through diagnostics a student model. And a student model is its understanding of what you know, right? So, and this could be a very simplistic, for example, something like spaced repetition, where there's a model of how quickly you forget things and how often you should be reminded of them to not forget them. And then it could be just as simple as, do you remember this? Yes, no. So it has no idea of actually the domain, right? That's a very simplistic tutor, and there's all kinds of apps for learning languages and flashcards and stuff even today. But a more advanced app would be, these are the kind of mistakes that people frequently make, right? So if you made this mistake, I think that you actually didn't even understand this whole concept, and so maybe you need to go back and practice that concept, right? So, I mean, this could be a course in itself, and I'm not an expert in it, but just to kind of introduce that idea. So the disciplines that have been very much involved with this, one is artificial intelligence, of course, data mining, because the student is interacting with the computer and you're able to gather a huge amount of data, especially if there are a lot of students, right? It's a very rich interaction. Well, it's a very data-heavy interaction. You can measure when I press a button, right, what I say. You can have lots of numbers. And this idea of modeling knowledge, and especially learning from an expert. Okay, here's an expert who knows something. How can we represent that in a computer form so that we can actually transmit it to a student? And one of the best examples of this that's actually available publicly, I think, is the Open Learning Initiative at Carnegie Mellon, which they created a number of courses. They're openly, freely accessible. And you see they're mostly harder subjects. And what they tried to do was to have, it's not really so much the adaptive tutor, but it's very much that it's all packaged into one. They'll give you a little chunk of content, then they'll give you a test, right away. You know, every 5 minutes you'll do a little quiz, you'll do a little simulation. They have built-in simulations and graphs and virtual labs and everything. So you're constantly being quizzed. And they can then tell you, oh, you need to go back and read it again, or here's more material. And because they made it openly accessible and thousands of people are using it, they're getting massive amounts of data. And so, for example, I don't know if you've heard about A-B testing, which is very common in the web world, where you say half the people who go to Google one day see this version, half the people see this slightly different version. How many percentage click on a button, right? And Google does that all the time for, like, what shade of blue should this button be and all kinds of stuff, right? So they're able to do the same thing because they have so many people that they can say, here's two different snippets of text introducing, you know, a physical motion. Okay, we're going to give half the students this text, half the students that other text, and then they're going to have a little quiz.
Brilliant.
Well, it's related to surveillance as well. In fact, this system calls itself Open Educational Resources. All the content is open, but the software is not open source. You cannot run this on your own site. It's free to use. And the reason they don't let U of T, for example, install this on their own server is because they want their data. And that's actually how they fund it, is that they get huge research funding for, you know, doing interesting research on it. So that's very interesting. But yeah, you're right, it's also surveillance. Anyway, so here you see just that's from the same website, so it's just a quick example. And you can have a look at that. And so I mentioned this idea of data mining, and learning analytics actually is becoming a very hot topic. There's a conference just in a few weeks, which you might be interested in if this is interesting to you. I went to it last year, and it was quite fascinating to see. And a lot of this also comes from distance education and online learning, because so much data is automatically captured, right? In this classroom, unless you install some very advanced machine, there's nothing that captures who speaks when, who responds to who, how long do we speak, what words do we use, right? If we were doing this online in the chat room, all of that would automatically be available without adding anything. And we could immediately make like a word cloud of this class, and we could, you know, graph it over 12 weeks and see how it changed. And so because that data is, I mean, available, if people start playing with it, right? So the other field, though, is this idea of computers enhancing human work with ideas and collaboration. And I don't know if Steve Jobs was the guy who said this first, but I like this concept of computers as a bicycle for our minds, in that it extends, you know, and it's actually, again, very related to the cyborg idea, right? It's extended cognition. It's it becomes part of us. When you're on a bicycle riding down a hill, you don't think, oh, I'm going to push my arm so that I tell the bicycle to turn left, and you turn left, you turn right. It's a part of what you're doing. So when they're coming up with tools that, you know, whether it's helping you brainstorm, whether it's helping you take notes, it's helping you sort through ideas. The ideal to many is to make that as seamless as riding a bicycle is. And to many of us it is, right? I mean, where are we with our iPhones today? It's an extension of the self, or maybe it's a scary extension, but either way. But it's both for the individual, but also for groups. So, you know, academic fields related to this, and there are more than this, but there are two sister fields of computer-supported collaborative work, CSCW, and computer-supported collaborative learning, CSCL. And then you have more general human-computer interaction, which looks at, obviously, and both of the two, you know, all of these fields are heavily kind of relevant to KMDI and the KMDI, and mentioned in many of the KMDI courses. CSCW, I have a feeling, I find it really, really interesting, but I have a feeling that academic field is kind of waning, which I think is because it's going mainstream. Like, so much of what was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, like a frontier field, now there's, you know, there's so many different people researching use of Twitter in the work, use of collaborative editing, use of video conferencing, use of wikis, knowledge management. You know, it's not really one coherent field anymore. Whereas CSCL, computer-supported collaborative learning, I think has more of an identity as a unified field properly. And that's, for example, where my supervisor, Jim Slava, and a few other people in CTL would probably find they belong. So you have those two kind of long traditions, right? And there might be others as well. So the third kind of thing that's been, you know, changing for the last 30, 40 years is this idea that it's much easier to access and to distribute content online, obviously. And there is a lot more of it, and that's related. But there's not just the ease of it, but there's also the idea that it's a good thing to share knowledge openly. I mean, there have been some choices made, and there have been some ideologies that aren't obvious, right? Everything, you know, the fact that every single newspaper basically is on the net for free without the login isn't an obvious result, probably, right? It could have been completely different, but that is right now at least how it is. So we have access, and especially in English, because I'm interested in linguistic issues, and I realize that that's definitely not the case in all languages, but certainly in English, there's an incredible amount of information available to anyone with an internet connection. There's also an incredible array of ways of communicating between individuals, between groups, between networks, publishing yourself, and so on and so on, right? So although most of that was not designed for education, it has obvious implications for education, right? And as I was saying, it's not just that the technology enables us, but that there are ideologies and philosophies and movements that, you know, push forward this open sharing of information. And there's open source, there's open access, open everything. I have given talks about this for 2 hours, that one today, but either way. So, okay, what does that mean, right? And I'm specifically interested in learning for, let's say, university level adults, and also informal learning outside of institutions. So I'm excluding huge areas from my look right now, but I'm, you know, interested in the idea of a person who's not currently in an institution anywhere in the world, and let's keep it in English just for simplicity, who wants to learn something. Okay, what are the kind of new possibilities and affordances that are available, that are becoming available? What are the implications of that? What are the challenges? So one of the things that we have now, and I come up with these crazy long names, site-specific information-centric communities. What that means is, and I just made that up, I don't expect it to be widely cited, but anyway, it's descriptive. This is just one way of organizing socially, right? So it could be a website, and in this case, it's something called Stack Overflow for programmers, but you can find these kind of websites in almost any field. I mean, if you're a knitter, right? If you're a scuba diver, if you're an ornithologist, you'll find communities of people who are fiercely passionate and incredibly knowledgeable and willing to share their knowledge. And Stack Overflow is an interesting case because they have some game mechanisms. That's something you'll also come across again and again. Gamification is this big, big thing now, right? So you get points for asking questions. If people vote up your question, if you answer a question, you can get voted as the right answer and stuff like that. And in fact, a lot of people get jobs based on their participation in this website, because it shows not only are they considered to be experts in their domain, but they're social, right? And that's, for programmers, isn't always a given. So the fact that you have someone who's really helpful and able to explain to other people is an extra kind of bonus. And I use this frequently if I have a technical problem. So it's a nice thing. So it's a site-specific, right? It's a certain website, and I don't know those people. We don't have a pre-existing social relationship, but by going to that website, there are certain community norms enforced through code. We talked about Lawrence Lessig, right? Legal code versus computer code. So there's a bunch of norms enforced through computer code. Then there are some community norms. Then you have distributed topic-based communities. So what I was just talking about was one single website, okay? And it's run by a company, and they seem to be fairly benign, but you know, they could take it away tomorrow, and then maybe we'd have to create another one. But this is more of a distributed community, and this is a website, but what it does is it simply sucks in a lot of different blogs, right? So if I write something on my personal blog about open educational resources, it'll pop up here because I used the right tag, right? And so if someone took this website away, all that content would still be there, and there would be lots of other ways of aggregating it. And so it's not so much going to a specific website, but it's using Web 2.0 facilities like hashtags, like trackbacks. When you comment on someone's blog and or refer to someone's blog, it's almost like a site in an academic article, right? You can follow that network. But again, you typically get blogospheres. So you have a group of people who frequently blog about open education, who have an inner core, who might know each other, who, oh, those two are going at it again, right? I mean, it's like in any community, like in a noisy community where you, and then, but it's fairly open, both because anyone can go and read those things and observe without being observed through, you know, and you can participate and you can have peripheral participation. You can, you know, so there's the whole community kind of dynamics that we've known, we've read articles about.
Yep.
Yes. So you don't have to remember it.
Yeah, okay.
You have to cite it in your next paper and my name. Yeah,
I'll do that for sure.
I'm trying to build, you know, credibility. This is just another example of Twitter. And all I did was I searched for the hashtag OA, which is open access, and you see a bunch of people all writing interesting stuff about open access. I might not know their names before, but this is how I actually use Twitter a lot. I do follow a lot of people. If people follow me and they're interesting, I'll follow them back. But I almost never read my, you know, what they call the fire hose, because it's just like you're trying to drink from the fire hose and it blows you away, right? So instead, I subscribe to keywords, saved searches, and I say, oh, whenever anyone says something new about open access, OER, whatever, I get a little ping, right? And you can filter through that. But the problem with that is, of course, then people start, if there's a very popular hashtag, people might start spamming it. Or there's hashtag collision, because you don't have to apply for a hashtag anywhere, you just choose it. So suddenly you end up with two totally different things using the same hashtag. But, you know, this is evolving stuff. So that kind of idea of saying, you know, we need to kind of learn how to use these different tools and to connect with people and build up our networks. And by tools, I both mean tools to produce, tools to read, but also tools to aggregate, right? So saved searches in Twitter, Google Reader maybe, or a similar tool for reading a lot of blogs, right? And that has gotten a name called personal learning environment or personal learning network, right? So there's people doing research on how can we support students or professionals in building up their own PLE. There's actually a Canadian Research Council has a big project on that, and they've got some interesting articles. And this is just one example of Sarah Stewart, who's kind of showing, you know, this is the tools, those are the tools that I found useful for myself. However, there seems to be, you know, so all of these things are really wonderful, and I use them all the time, and it's where I do a lot of my learning. There seems to be something, you know, important about synchronicity. And this is an old blog post by Mike Caulfield about cohorts, which was really kind of useful for me in kind of gelling this concept. And the idea that moving together through a learning pathway as a group at a certain time has a number of valuable properties to it. So for Stack Overflow, you could go there anytime, and, you know, if the question's been answered, you can find it, right? For the blogosphere, it's synchronous in that, oh, you can see what's new, but it never stops and it never starts. It flows through time, might ebb and, you know, rise, but it doesn't have a start and an end date, right? And I think there is something, and also based on all my experience and experiments, there are some really interesting things with this concept of, you know, it could be a course, it could be a book club. We're going to read this book, right? We're going to read a chapter a week for 2 months. And you make time in your schedule, and you know that that there's a certain group of people, and they've all read that chapter, as opposed to, yeah, you know, I'm coming here, and maybe they read it 10 years ago, and I'm reading their comments now, right? So Okay, well, if there is something interesting about this cohort, okay, so how can we recreate that, or how can we play with that concept in this open sphere, right? And so there's this idea of not just open content, not just open interaction, but actually open courses. And so one of the early examples that I came across, which kind of started me on this whole journey when I was an undergrad, was a guy called David Wiley. He was at the Utah State University back then, and he had a graduate level course called Introduction to Open Education. And it was taught online, and so he thought, using something similar maybe to Pepper or whatever like that. And he thought, if I'm teaching about open education, I should really try to open it up, but then what does that really mean? Back then, people weren't quite sure what that looked like. And so he said, I want to make it technologically very simple, because it's not really about, gee whiz kind of stuff. So he set up a wiki, he put his whole syllabus online, he made sure that all the readings were open access, which is the case in our class too. We didn't, exclude anything that wasn't open access, but in fact, most of it is found, and he made sure that everything was available. And then, he said, okay, sign up here. There's no criteria for taking this class, but you have to work really hard, right? Just like in this class. Like, there'll be tough readings, and there'll be questions, and I want you to answer on your own blog, right? So you own the space in which you are speaking. And that's kind of an interesting psychological difference from you are kind of the guest in Pepper, where someone's the admin and they have different rights from you, right? Talking once again about code, okay? So nobody controls my blog except me. Now, you can control whether my blog shows up on your list or not. That's a different thing, but I have full rights on my blog. So that's quite an interesting, actually, thing to look into. So, maybe 30 people signed up. This wasn't a huge thing. And of them, or maybe 60 people, but let's say 20 people actually went through with it, because a lot of people were just curious. And I went through with it, and since I wrote on my blog, those are still there. If you go back to my blog, you'll find all the stuff I wrote in 2007, I think it was. I was a full-time undergrad student. I spent probably one full day a week on this thing, because I was so interested in it, right? And not because I was going to get any diploma at the end. I didn't care less. I was so fascinated by this topic and by seeing what everyone else wrote and by getting their comments to me. And so I was inspired by how simple it was technologically and how powerful it was in terms of a learning experience and how different it was from just being part of the open education blogosphere, which already existed. And I could read David Wiley's blog and I could read other people's blogs and I could blog, and if I was lucky, maybe they would read mine. But there was something about having that concerted energy, right? And back then I did think, it would be great if we could mainstream this, make this, because right then, basically to have such a course, you needed, and in fact, there was a bunch of other people starting courses at around the same time, inspired by him, and so they got the informal name Wiley Wikis. They all tended to be men, interestingly. They tended to be people who had very secure foundations in their institutions, because you have to convince them that this is a good idea to give away your course for free. He actually had a few people at his institution that took it for credit, and he reviewed their submissions and stuff, and he argued to the university that this was making their learning experience much more valuable, because they actually got exposed to so many other viewpoints. So that was how he was able to sell it to the university. But you need the technology, even though it's not a lot, it's still a barrier to many people. And you need to go out and market yourself, right? And say, hey guys, I'm starting this course, come, you know? There wasn't a platform where he could just list it and people would go and check it. So partly inspired by this and partly inspired by a lot of other things, together with some other people, we started something called the Peer-to-Peer University. And the idea of that, and this is just an example course in Portuguese, just to be a bit international, was to create a platform where people who wanted to run these courses could do so, where there was the technological support, the social support, where people would know where to look for it, so you didn't have to go and kind of advertise it by yourself, and where hopefully we could learn from, gather a body of experience and learn from this and try to understand what is working, what isn't, how can we take this forward. And it's gone through a number of iterations. This is a very old version of our website. And I actually ran a course on this platform just a year ago. And the course was called Introduction to Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning. So one of the fields I introduced to you. And the reason I ran this course was not because I considered myself an expert in the topic. The opposite, I really wanted to take that course at OISE, because that's, you know, it's the foundation, it would be like the introduction to the field that I'm in. There is no such course at OISE, right? And so what to do? Well, I needed to read all those foundational papers anyway. I might as well find a group of interesting, intelligent people to read them with me. Because, you know, imagine if you're reading the Cyborg Manifesto by yourself in your room, and then you try to call some of your friends, and you're like, hey, I've got this 50-page, really pretty dense thing. I really want to discuss it with someone. Can you just read it and get back to me?
Find another friend.
Right? That's a hard sell. It's much easier if you have a group of people like this who are kind of committed to, you know that they've all read it. And, I mean, obviously we're benefiting enormously from Megan. But even if Megan wasn't here, we would definitely get more out of this sitting around the table than we would individually by ourselves, right? So that was kind of the idea. And I was, of course, also interested in just testing this out and seeing what are the kind of issues that arise from this kind of open learning. This wasn't the homepage, but I used something called NetVibes just to pull in everyone's blogs. There's actually a few students from OISE that participated as well, Rebecca Kober and Monica Resendez and Jennifer Claro. So we used blogs, we used the P2P website, we had kind of chat meetings once a week, and I actually moved to China in the middle of this, so I had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday to chat with people, but nobody ever missed it. It was really exciting. And, you know, we ran into a bunch of interesting problems / challenges, but it was also an incredibly rich learning experience. And I thought about, you know, what does it mean for a course to be open? There's actually a lot of different dimensions to that. So, for example, transparency is one dimension, right? In our case, Pepper is closed to anyone who's not in this class. So all the long discussions that we have there are only available to us, right? And there might be other people out there who are reading the same article who would find this really insightful. They can't get access. But on the other hand, there might be things that we're saying that are really personal, or that we feel, oh, I'm just testing this theory out. I don't really want to put my name on it for now and forever. And we heard early in this course, once you put it on the internet, you never get it off, right? So there's an interesting, you know, how does that affect what is being said? There's no grades, right? I'm not in a position to give people grades. I'm not an expert. There's no coercion. To me, coercion is when you're kind of using grades to compel certain behavior, right? You can give people grades because you're evaluating them, but I think a lot of what we do in graduate school is that we're saying, you know, you have to post twice a week, otherwise you get a horrible participation mark. In that case, we're not really testing your ability to post twice a week, right? But we're saying, we believe as educators that you will learn more if you post twice a week. We also believe that you're not all self-disciplined enough or motivated enough to do that by us just telling you, so we're going to compel you by using kind of a forceful method, right? Because your grades are important to you. So in this case, we had there's no way I can compel anyone to do anything. And that's tricky, actually. One of the reasons why people like courses is because they know that they don't have that self-discipline, right? And same thing with deadlines and stuff. So that's another aspect. There's no certification at the end. There's no assessment except for peer assessment, which obviously is, and that's actually something we're working on developing further. There is less credibility and authority of instructors. So in this course, even if there wasn't a final grade, some people might put in a lot of work, partly because they respect Megan in a personal capacity, but also, and I'm reflecting myself here, because you're probably going to be around OISE for a few more years. You might need a thesis advisor. You know, you don't want her to get a horrible impression of you, right? So there are different ways in which you might, let's say me, because I'm not going to project on you. I might choose to put in a lot of work even though I might not care about the grades, right? At P2PU, you know, went out of our way to say, we are not experts here. We want to make this democratic. But that also undermined our authority. And so when we said, here is the plan that we have for the class, and we spent a lot of time on that plan, and we thought it was a good plan, and people said, why should your work count anything more than us? And we was like, yeah, we're kind of for democracy. But what ended up happening is that we spent so much time discussing how the course was organized, sometimes we didn't have time to learn. So that was an interesting tension, which I'd never even considered before, right? So, and of course, so one is the perceived authority, and the other one is the actual. You know, we did know a lot less, right? So those are related. Anyway, those are just a few. I could throw up a lot more. And actually, if you went and looked at the notes that I wrote from that course, you would see in detail me going through all the kind of things that we learned and things that I think would be interesting to look into. And, anyway, so we did have... So we had 13 participants, but I think there were six... plus the two course organizers, I had a couple of course organizers that, you know, were very active. And the people who dropped off were pretty much dropping off during the first or second week. So after the initial weeding, it was very stable, which was nice. And then, you know, talking about this transparency, and this was a new idea, we had followers. And initial, before P2P course, were always transparent. You could always go and look at them, and you can do that today as well. But there was no kind of official way of saying, I want to follow this course, but I don't have time for all the work. I don't want to be bound socially by the expectation that I'm going to do it. And we added that, and it's based kind of on Twitter, right? Because the difference between Twitter and Facebook, on Facebook, when you say, I'm your friend, that's a reciprocal thing. That person has to say, is it really your friend? Right? On Twitter, when you choose to follow someone, they don't get an option unless they've protected their tweets because it's more of a channel. Right, so I'm putting it out there. If you want to subscribe to my tweets, you know, you can do so. And that was the same idea. So by signing up, you would get updates in your email box or however about new stuff, and you would be encouraged to read it. And you wouldn't be able to. And this is something we might play with tweaking. You wouldn't have any write access. You can post to the forums, but a lot of the interaction was happening on our own blogs. And again, you could. Very freely read from this course and then post something on your blog. And what I was hoping to do was then to aggregate that back and say, here's what, you know, the core group of people who are meeting every week, this is what they're doing. And, oh, look, this week we said something really interesting and it created kind of a chain effect and a bunch of people started discussing it.
Do you have any distribution of distribution, how much they really followed and were active in the auditing?
Yeah, so we don't have, we could probably surveil them and look at that, it's at least if they're logged in. We didn't do that, but we did, I sent out a survey to all the followers. So all the students in the class, they actually answered some questions in the forum, and you can go back and read that if you want to. But for the followers, so we got 10 replies out of 50, which is low, but it's expected because these were by definition people who were less involved. And most of them were saying, oh yeah, it was kind of neat. You know, I was interested. I didn't really read a lot. I might go back. A lot of people said, I don't know if they do, but they're like, oh, I was really busy. I might go back and kind of look through the material later. There was one guy, though, who blew me away. This Brazilian student who, and you can read more about him, and I actually posted an interview with him on my blog, who's like, I loved it. I read everything. I'm going to change my master's thesis topic because of this course. And I was like, you know, he probably spent more time on this course than any of us, but he was, you know, nervous about his English not being good enough. And so he didn't dare to kind of sign up and make that commitment, but he spent a huge amount of time on the course. And so I asked him, which part of the course was useful to you? Was it that we had found all these articles, that we spent a lot of time finding good articles, we systematized it, we make a nice outline, we had, you know, we did all that work. Or was it that you were able to see our kind of back and forth discussions, probings? And he said both, because, I mean, of course the articles were important, but sometimes when he couldn't understand, just like, you know, let's say you were following this course from a distance and we didn't know that you were there. and you're reading the Cyborg Manifesto and you're sitting there by yourself, you don't really have anyone to discuss it with, but at least you can listen in on us. And that'll give you some understanding and seeing how we grapple with it, and also some comfort in knowing that you're not stupid because you can understand everything. So that was really fascinating to me. If I hadn't sent out that survey, I would have never known that there was such a learning effect, right? Anyway, this is just something new we're experimenting with, which is actually going back a little bit to the asynchronous model, where we're creating these challenges. So, and it's more hands-on. Like, if you want to learn how to program in a certain way, here's the steps that you can go through. And then the idea is, at every step, you'll be able to find other people who are at the same step as you, and you can help each other and give feedback and stuff. But people might move through this at different paces. And part of the reason we started with this is because there were so many people who were interested in certain topics. Like, we'd start a course for web programming, and there'd be like 400 people signing up. And we're like, we can't help you as a community. So what we were trying to do is see, can we scale it in this way? But I think this is something that only works for certain topics, and this is something you'll actually see more as we go forward. So here you see people can register, and they say, I'm doing this challenge right now. I've completed it. I've offered to help. So if you get lost, they can mentor you and stuff like that. But at the same time, or shortly after David Wiley tried this, seminar style course is what I would call it. 20 people, they're all reading each other's blog posts and commenting and stuff. Some other Canadians, George Siemens and Stephen Downs, they tried something similar, but it kind of became huge. And they have this learning theory called connectivism, and there's a lot of people interested in that. So, when the people who came up with the theory are kind of offering a course about it, they attracted a lot of interest. And I think they had, if you just look at the webpage, the design seems very similar to what David Wiley did. But instead of 30 people, they had 2,000 people sign up. And when you have 2,000 people, again, you can't do a seminar course, right? You can't have everyone read every blog. You can't have the teacher read every blog and comment and so on. And so what they did, and this is kind of in line with their entire learning philosophy, is that they say, we want you to self-organize. We're going to provide a red thread. So we're going to have some readings that are common every week. We might have some people come in and give talks online. But you organize in those small groups or in networks or whatever. Some of you might want to meet in Second Life because you like that feeling of being an avatar and walking up to other people. Some of you might want to have a mailing list. Some of you might want to meet with a few people in your city for coffee every week if you can find other people taking the course, because this was global, right? Some of you might want to do a mailing list in Spanish because you can read English, but you're much more comfortable discussing in Spanish. And all of those and more examples did happen, right? Without teachers coordinating it or organizing it, they kind of just provided the space for that to happen. So very confusing, right? It's kind of like, it's more like being at a festival, like Woodstock of learning, right? There's no way you can read or keep track of everything, but there's a huge amount of stuff happening. And in one way, you could also say it's straddling the line between a course and a conference, because these people, this is a topic, this is very different from adaptive tutoring. This is not even a knowledge field that isn't bounded, but it's one that is in rapid development. It's at the kind of cusp of, it's the actual cutting edge. And so the outcome of the course was not just a lot of people who had learned more about the topic, but the topic itself had progressed measurably, right? It made a huge contribution to research, basically. So it was kind of like this massive distributed conference in a way. Synchronous again, right? Just like a conference. So they did that. You can go to so they called it the Massive Open Online Course. And you can go to MOOC.ca, and you can see they have had a ton of different courses. And there's one going on right now called Change.MOOC, which is a full year course. So it's got maybe a few weeks left, but you can go back and look. And they had like 30 different guest speakers or something. Really top people in all kinds of different directions, and a huge amount of open material you can kind of dig into. So really kind of fascinating stuff. And there's been actually a bunch of interesting research articles written about it too, because in this case also you get a huge amount of data just because there's so many people participating, right? If you have 2,000 people blogging, and because all of this, that stuff is done in the open. So you can, you know, it's not OLI controlling that data anymore, right? It's happening on my blog platform and your blog platform. And because we have these open standards, RSS feeds, Twitter, APIs and stuff, we can, people can suck that in. They can do social network graphs. They can do semantic analysis. And there's a bunch of interesting research papers about it.
It is cooperation. It's in the end for money? I mean,
no, it's all free.
They're doing it?
Yeah, totally free. One is a professor at Athabasca University. One is a researcher with the Canadian Research Council. Who started it, and then some of these have been done by other people, but this is, you know, for the love of it. And one of the ways they kind of try to keep it together, because obviously it's very overwhelming, is that they have a daily mail out for those who sign up, where they try to, you know, skim the, and choose some of the most interesting posts. But there's, you know, and the thing is, anyone else could do that as well, right? So that's not privileged to the instructor. Anyone else could say, "Oh, I'm going to choose some of the great stuff and have it here, and you can subscribe to my list instead."
But I was really—isn't it really interesting that like most of course are related with technology?
Yep.
And they are teaching technology, mm-hmm. So even though like you just said that like most instructor could do that, but usually the instructor who are interested in like this critical thing, they don't use this.
Yeah.
Like, those people are just doing CSCL.
Yeah.
All titles and course contents. I think for me, really overlapped, and they are doing it. Small group of people,
mm-hmm.
CSS of people, they are doing that by themselves, and they're having fun, really great, but still, like, up with all these things, we need to go through these all traditional.
So, if you look at P2PU, we have an incredible diversity of courses, and that's exactly what we were aiming for. So, there's courses on poetry, there's courses on history, there's courses on teaching gender. There's actually we had some teaching related courses, K-12. There's all kinds of interesting. There's actually cyberpunk course, which is quite interesting. MOOCs right now are kind of in the same situation that David Wiley's course was, right? So it's even much more technologically complex, and it's something where you are putting yourself out there not just for 30 people, but for 2,000 people, right? And the people who do that, yet they tend to be very deeply embedded in this movement, and so the courses that they teach tend to be exactly what you were just saying.
So, I think that the question is whether even Illich can represent this.
Well, he's been invoked a lot by people in this movement, for sure.
No, but do you think that we are pertinent, or it's will remain in the margins of the institutionalized education?
Well, I think this is gonna grow and make a serious impact. But I'm gonna continue, and then you can see at the end what you think. So, going back though to open courses, right? So, kind of trying to trace the different historical precedents here. Open courses kind of started around 2000. Well, you know, you could find precedents before that, but 2001, the idea for MIT OpenCourseWare, which I'm assuming everyone's seen before, the first courses were published in 2003. So they've been going for almost 10 years now. So they have about 1,800 courses, almost every single course, although there's very big difference how much material for each course, because these aren't courses designed for the web. This is courses that were in person, where they took whatever, you know, PDFs and PowerPoints and whatever and put it online. But it inspired a global movement of content, right? So this is content. There's no social interaction, nothing, right? But it's a lot of good or bad, you know, content. And to me, it's exciting because also it's spread globally. And again, I'm really interested in these flows of knowledge that don't go only from the West to the rest, but ideally in different directions. And for me, being able to go and click, you know, pedagogically watching a two-hour video of someone lecturing in a classroom might not be ideal. But for me, being able to peek into an Indian classroom or Mexican classroom and seeing an authentic situation, right, is actually really fascinating. And just to illustrate that, I made this tiny little clip. So this is a 2-minute whirlwind tour of the globe. Oops. Come on. There we go. Oh, sound.
पिछले 200 सालों में दुनिया की तस्वीर बिल्कुल बदल दी. ऊंची ऊंची इमारतों, तीव्र वाहनों.
Begin by welcoming you all to the video course on engineering geology. My name is Devashish Roy. I teach in the Department of Civil Engineering of Indian Institute of Technology, Kharagpur. Now, you all know that Earth is essentially a spherical body.
Shankar. 马克思的 1844年 经济学哲学手稿第六节对黑格尔的辩证法和一般哲学的批判作为推动原则和创造原则的否定性讲的就是否定否定之否定
What is literature? Literature is a term used to describe written or spoken material. Broadly speaking, literature is used to describe anything.
この皆さんがそのどの年代に私の講義を聞いたかによってあの頃の先生。La organización de la administración pública federal, en donde revisaremos la forma de organización central, descentralizada y desconcentrada. El por qué considero determinante que ustedes ubiquen y sepan diferenciar cada una de estas formas es porque cada una de ellas va a tener un impacto en otros aspectos, sobre todo en la forma de control de cada una de ellas.
We have here X, and I would have here this force F, which I know because I know the masses, I can change the masses, I can go through a whole lot of them. There are ways that you can also measure the spring constant in a dynamic way. These marks here are 13 centimeters apart, and every time that I put 1 kilogram on, you will see that it goes down by roughly 13 centimeters.
So the last one that you see is actually the most popular lecture from MIT, millions of hits, because he's got a very charismatic way of doing it. He's, you know, swinging himself from cables and narrowly escaping death. But this is actually a video I made for a few years ago. I gave a talk about open education around the world. But to me, it's just kind of wonderful to see, you know, pedagogy or not, just the fact of being able to traverse the world like that is quite exciting. But obviously, as you noticed, some of these lecturers seemed less than charismatic, frankly, and maybe not that exciting. But it was a really important beginning move, right? So where have we gone since then? Well, I'm assuming most of you have heard about Khan Academy, and there's been a lot of discussion about the usefulness of these videos. They've been incredibly popular. In fact, Khan Academy videos on YouTube have more views than any video, like all the videos from MIT together, right, made by one person. And you could discuss this from a bunch of perspectives, but what I want to point out is, first of all, you know, the length of these videos. And partly it might be because when he started putting these on YouTube, YouTube had a limitation of 10 minutes. They don't anymore, but they do, and probably that's a good thing that they did. Again, it's interesting, this code and how it changes social stuff. So all of his videos are shorter than 10 minutes. And so they're very, you know, instead of having a 2-hour lecture, just because that happens to be the format that fits if you're having to do the schedule and you have to drive it in from Mississauga, you know, that might not be the pedagogically ideal time period, right? And the other thing is that he's not filming himself standing in front of a lecture board. He uses a tablet, and he gives you the sense that he's almost sitting next to you and showing you something, right? He's like, okay, I'll just talk you through this. Look, if you do this and that, and even though video, you know, you think of video and you think of something that's very passive, It's like a lean back medium rather than lean forwards. In this case, both because it's so hands-on, like you could almost follow along, and because you are in control, right? It's an individual watching, so you can pause it at any time. You can play it. A lot of people play it at twice the speed, you know, and then they pause it when they get somewhere. And because they're so short, you can quickly jump and navigate, right? Instead of having to listen to 2 hours, you might come to somewhere and you're like, oh, I forgot how you do that. And you can then quickly jump and see how you do that, right? So it's kind of empowering to you as a student. And they've also built now, they got a bunch of funding, so they started to build where they're kind of mapping out the relationship between all the videos, and they have these quizzes. So you get a little bit back that adaptive tutoring aspect, but now using video as kind of the transmission model. And this, apart from Khan Academy itself being fairly successful, getting a lot of funding and stuff like that, I think it has had a huge impact on the examples that we're going to see right now. How many of you have heard about this course? So this is Sebastian Truyn and Petter Norvig, two of the most well-known artificial intelligence researchers in the world at Stanford. Peter Norvig is director of research at Google, so Sebastian Truyn is a Google fellow as well. And they said, hey, this is kind of funny too compared to the MIT thing, because the MIT thing, it was always very political, very publicity. They announced it in a huge press conference. They got lots of millions in funding. We're going to do this, visionary thing and blah, blah, blah. These guys just suddenly one day threw this webpage up saying, hey, we're going to do this artificial intelligence course. It's open to anyone. It's free. Starting in a month, give us your email. It looked more like a Web 2.0 startup than some big project, right? The crazy thing is, so we started with 30 people from David Wiley. Then we got to 2,000 people with the MOOCs, and we're like, wow. These guys got something like 250,000 people. Okay? Who gave them their email, right? Which is pretty crazy. And it's not like the most... artificial intelligence sounds pretty sexy, but, it's not the most useful to most people or most, public appeal. And this was a hardcore course. This was like the math, and you need to do algebra. You need to work through it. It wasn't just read a few articles and say what you think about it, right? Now, what's interesting is that, they were doing it in partnership with Stanford. There were professors at Stanford. Obviously, you're not going to get any recognition from Stanford, but they said, I will write you a personal letter. And because there is evaluation built in, I'm going to tell you in what percentile of Stanford students you would have been had you been at Stanford. And I'm going to sign that as Sebastian Truyn and Norvig, who are like the top people in AI. So you go to your employer and you say, look, Sebastian Truyn sent me this letter saying I would be in the 99th percentile. They might actually take that seriously, right? So it was a really interesting case. And again, the way they kind of designed it, what does that remind you of? Reminds you of Khan Academy, right? They didn't have someone film their two-hour lecture, because they've been giving this class at Stanford for years. They didn't have someone just film their two-hour lectures. They totally redesigned the course. They had like a ton of teaching assistants that were fairly techy. They did, look here at the bottom, I don't know if you can see it. This is a 2-minute video. Okay, we're not even talking 10 minutes anymore. We're talking 2-minute videos, 3-minute videos, tons of them, right? And lots of quizzes. Even programming exercises. And the nice thing about programming is that you can actually automatically test if it runs and functions. So you have to work on it, right? And so, okay, 250,000 people left you their email. Well, 30,000 people did the midterm. To me, that's actually a much more impressive number because it's easy to get people's emails. But that means like twice as many students as Stanford probably has in total went through the exercise, and these were like 8 hours a week. Like this was pretty. I've looked at some of it myself, and they did the midterm. Now, the basic design of the course was not social at all, right? If you look at this page, you see videos, you see quizzes. It looks very much like Open Learning Initiative, except it's video instead of text. But other than that, it's very much. And talking about discipline, this is a bounded area. Even though artificial intelligence is, of course, something that's developing very rapidly, but this wasn't a bunch of researchers that were pushing the boundaries of AI. This was people who are learning, okay, if you want to be able to calculate this, you need to know this, this, and this, right? Very well understood kind of area. However, again, because we're on the open web, and because there are so many people, and of course, most people taking these courses are fairly web savvy, typically, they were able to go other places and create that social interaction that the professor didn't offer, and thus, in extension, didn't control. Okay, so for example, they set up a discussion forum called IQs, which had thousands and thousands and thousands of posts where people could post questions. And you see, it looks actually, I think they actually used a software that's very similar to Stack Overflow, but it's open source. And here you see someone is asking a question, fairly technical question, and gets lots of answers. I mean, and the level of quality of these questions and answers were actually incredibly high, because a lot of the people taking these courses were like professors of math or engineers, or they weren't necessarily undergrad students at all. So the nice thing again is, like, this is something that has nothing to do with the professors. If the professor wanted to shut it down, they couldn't, right? It has nothing to do with Stanford. So people were able to go in other places, and this wasn't the only place. There was discussion forums on Reddit, there was discussion forums on other places. So it's, in that sense, it's some of the spirit from the early MOOCs, right?
Can I just ask,
yes,
how did people know where to go?
Right, so that's where, Google, typically,
okay.
or hearing about it.
Wasn't
but yeah,
that then the professors reacted by letting people know where they could go to get that.
I don't think so.
Okay.
At least not initially. Like, maybe once these got popular, but they kind of grew up organically.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I've complained about, for example, with MIT OpenCourseWare. Now, the nice thing about this was that there was actually this one, there was another one on machine learning, but they were massive. Everyone within a certain circle were talking about this, right? Even if you weren't taking the course, you were curious about it, fascinated by it. For MIT, they have 1,800 courses. Now, if I wanted to, do something about the Chinese course, I can't do anything. Like, one thing is I can't create social structure, but I also can't edit it or improve it or whatever, even though I have the license to do so, but I can't do it on their site, right? Okay, fine, so I'll download the Chinese course and I'll put it on my site, but there is no function to create that trackback. And there it's like, well, how do I get those people to go to the Chinese course to know that I'm doing it? And that's been a criticism of mine of the MIT thing. So here you see an example of these letters that they sent out to students, right? And here you see someone who got top 10% of the class. He blogged about it because he was really proud of himself. that's something that's really, like having a challenge. And it's also, it's much easier to measure, right? I mean, I feel like, in this class, when you're giving grades, you almost have to grade on a curve, because there's no objective good at media literacy or critical. There's better or worse, but where do you put the A, where do you put the B? It really has to be on a curve, whether it's on a curve within this class or within this university or whatever. Whereas you can say, yes, he got all the questions correct, and these questions were also asked to Stanford students, so wow, I'm able to test myself against Stanford students. That's something, that's a challenge that a lot of people would relish, right? Which is quite exciting. And in fact, they went further than that. And to the 1,000 top students, they sent an email and they said, could I have your CV? I'd like to connect you with some companies that are hiring in this field, right? Now, that might seem, this is interesting, that might seem very generous of these people. The fact, though, is within these very competitive industries, it's typical to get 10% of the first year salary as a signing bonus if you help them find the right people, because it's very hard to find top quality engineers. And this might be actually a future revenue stream for them, to give certain companies might pay to be able to contact the top 1,000 students, because those are going to be fought over, right? I mean, the other students, maybe not so much, but those top students, they're going to be fought over. So it's interesting, because when I first saw it, wow, that's so nice. They're like, they're trying to help these students. That's so generous of them, right? And then I was reading some commentary, and I was like, yeah, well, it's still nice, but, So this is then spun up into two different companies. So that's also the interesting thing about Stanford versus MIT. It never really was a Stanford initiative. It was kind of tolerated. And I think Truen, he actually quit his, he left his tenure track position because he said, and he had this thing on his blog where he said, you know, I've been teaching there for years. Every year I teach 50 students. And now this year I taught 30,000 students. And I just can't go back. Like, I want to have a bigger impact in the world. So he, and probably he's going to make lots of money from his company too, but hey. So he started this company called Udacity, and there's another company called Coursera. It's very like Silicon Valley style. And they have a bunch of courses now. So you see they have building a search engine, design of computer. So it's still very techy, right? Programming a robotic car. It's also interesting because building a search engine is basically introduction to computer science. But instead of calling it that, they kind of built it all around the project. But the stuff you learn, like the first class, is like, what is a variable, right? Very basic stuff, but it seems more exciting. And also they had, Sergey Brin was on the first video, like, welcoming you to the course. So these people are obviously able to get good people. Again, though, you see what they're doing, very similar to Khan Academy style. And they have these quizzes, and actually, like, a little cool technical thing, so they're able to overlay just straight over the video. So you watch something, quiz, you go to the next thing. They have a built-in programming environment, so you get a little task, write a few lines of code, try it, doesn't work, try it again, works, and submit. It checks if it works. Yes, it works. Okay, you go on, right? Now, going back to MIT, they haven't sat still since 2003 either. This is a separate company called Open Study, and their idea was, we want to be that social space, right? So it's basically a place where you can ask questions, hang out, discuss certain topics, get homework help. But they were able to get a deal with MIT. So if you go to that Chinese course, which I was complaining about, now there is actually a link, but it's only one, right? If I put something competing, there won't be a link there. But there's one link because they're worried about their reputation or whatever, and spam and all that. But there's one link that says, do you want to discuss this with others? Then you go to the Chinese forum on Open Study, right? And I don't think that's actually been a huge success, but that's at least how they were trying. Then, and I don't know if they've been discussing this for a long time or whether they were kind of pushed by Stanford, they just announced MITx, okay? TEDx, MITx. And this is where they're going to have full courses, because, as I said, a lot of the MIT courses were designed, they were just random PDFs and stuff. This is actually like fully designed to be a self-contained course. It's free, and you will get not an MIT diploma, but an MITx diploma, right? So again, they're still not willing to kind of sully their good name and reputation, but they're going much closer than Stanford, which just, some random professor can write you a letter, right? There they actually know this is something official. It's kind of like a continuing school, right?
It's not free as well.
Sorry?
It's not free.
It is.
They said they will like have...
So the... Yes. The... No. The course is completely free. If you want the diploma, you have to pay. And that's and it'll be a lot less than you... But, because there will be a human person actually looking through. And so they'll be... Because right now, if you come to a company with MITx diploma, nobody knows what to make of it. So they will have to establish that it's rigorous. And the way to do that is to, if the first person who comes to your company with that blows you away, then next time you see someone with it, you're going to respect it. If the person comes and says, oh, look, I've got lots of computer science, and you don't know the first thing, you're never going to believe it again, right? So that's the revenue model. Anyone can learn if you want to prove that you've learned, right? And then theoretically, and I don't know if you have anyone of you read the badge, any of the two badge papers that I assigned, but there we looked at different kind of peer ways of doing accreditation. So theoretically, someone could go through their entire course and then go somewhere else and demonstrate their learning, and then they would avoid the fee, right? So that's an interesting kind of roundabout. Anyway, I'm almost done. This is, by the way, how it looks. So again, they're all kind of converging on this little format. Here you see 3 minutes videos, right? Not the 2 hour kind of show that it was earlier. It's very accessible because they have the full transcript, which is very, very nice, obviously, for people who need that. So that's basically 8 o'clock. So I'm not going to... There's obviously like a huge amount of interesting ideas to discuss here. And I'm looking forward to discussing that over a beverage of your choice. Thank you.